Welcome aboard this edition of the MTOM Podcast. I'm Paul Yeager. This is a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. Thank you so very much for joining us. On the minds of us each and every week on the TV side of things is trade. We look at several aspects of trade, and one of the areas that has been getting a lot of attention has been soybeans, especially soybeans in China and China's desire to buy both soybeans and U.S. pork. But what is happening? How long before we see phase one implementation? Then, we know that has already happened, but when will we see buying? That's a discussion we had with our guest today, Grant Kimberly of the Iowa Soybean Association. He wears two hats. He's in market development for the Iowa Soybean Association, but he's also the executive director of the Iowa Biodiesel Board. Biodiesel and renewable fuels has been a major topic in the United States when it comes to small refinery exemptions, the RFS, and the EPA. We will get into both the topics of renewable fuels as well as market development and trade when we talk with Grant Kimberly. We'll also discuss some of his trips. He does wear two hats, and he has a unique perspective of history when it comes to China. His family farm was the home of a visit by the vice premier of China. When he was vice premier, he now is the premier of China. We'll hear that story about how Xi Jinping came to the Kimberly family farm. We'll also discuss how relationships translate when it comes to his current job and also how he is progressing in those areas of trying to find new markets for Iowa soybeans as well as soybeans in general. So sit back, hit play, enjoy this discussion with Grant Kimberly. And again, we always appreciate if you give us a 5-star review, share this with a friend, like it, subscribe, do whatever you want with it, just as long as you listen. Enjoy. When you answer the phone, how do you know which hat to answer the phone with? Because you've got so many that you wear here.
Yeah, I don't know is the answer to that, and usually I'm ready to be flexible, and I just a lot of times though the great thing is it does come through our receptionist first, and so they've already asked the question of who the person is and why they're calling, so when that happens that gives me a second or two before I pick up the phone and to kind of gather my thoughts to know which side of my brain I need to use.
Do you enjoy that part of the job?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I like the flexibility. I like the diversity of doing different things, working as part of the Iowa biodiesel industry and wearing that hat, and then also working as part of the soybean industry and wearing the farmer hat from our members. And of course, my family farms too, so that hat's pretty easy to wear.
All right. Well, since you opened the door to the family, let's just get into that. Your farm, your family farm, I believe I read your sixth generation to be involved with it. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you think about all the visitors that have come to your farm, I know some people will write down, take pictures, log. Has the family put together a book about all the visitors you've had?
We haven't put that together in that kind of capacity, but we have kept track of usually when we have delegations that come and give us gifts and so forth. We've kept most of those kind of in a separate little file, so to speak, whether it's a delegation from a different country, maybe it's a business delegation or a university, or it's maybe government related. So we try to keep track of all those things. We haven't started the sign-in book. I suppose we should. That's probably a good idea, but we haven't done that yet.
We did that for my uncle because he would get trade groups, and we'd have him put a pin. You've got a globe, a world map above your computer here, so you could do the pin. And I think if you had that book, because you never know, someone who visits in the 70s or 80s is going to be the premier of China.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, who would have thought?
How did you know? I mean, so how does that, that you go, that you know that President Xi had visited, and then do you track some of these people and know, oh, they're progressing through government, and before you know it, they're going to be
You know, no, you don't. I think, you know, everybody's just busy with taking care of things one day at a time. And so, yeah, most of the time you don't track that kind of thing. And, you know, even I think Governor Branstad didn't track that either until, you know, all of a sudden the story goes he was at a, I think, an international governor's conference, and Vice President Xi at the time was there and walked up to him and handed him his agenda, I think, from that 1985 trip that he kept. And I think even at that moment, Governor Branstad, I think, had to stop and think for a second when and where this all happened. But then I think it quickly came back to him, of course, and then the rest is history. And he got invited to come back to Iowa, and he did in 2012. And we were one of the fortunate people that got a chance to be a part of that pretty cool visit as well.
There's a picture of you sitting in, I assume it's the living room of the house, of the home place there. The governor's there, your father's there, Xi is there, and some other Chinese delegation. Is that the most famous family
Secretary
photo? Secretary Vilsack was in. Yeah, that's right. He was there too. Is that the most famous photo to come out of the Kimberly Farms living room?
I suppose it is, yeah, out of the living room, yeah. Besides that, of course, our family photos are always important, right?
Well, see, that's what you're supposed to say.
Those are always important.
Good job, Grant.
Those are always important. But, yeah, as far as a publicly famous thing, I guess that one, I don't know how you top it because it got published in a lot of Chinese news outlets, and, you know, they've got 1.3 or 4 billion people over there. So even if the entire U.S. population saw something, it wouldn't come close.
How active are you in the operation? What's the? I mean, do you get to get out of here in October?
My dad and I are in contact, you know, usually on a daily basis, and I'm out there a lot of times on weekends and evenings. Maybe not so much this time of the year, the slower time of the year, but you know, we don't have livestock anymore. We did have livestock growing up and all through college, but we've kind of phased out of that part of it. But yeah, I'm out there weekends, evenings most of the time, and then yeah, when it comes spring, the crunch time and the springtime and the fall time, I'll take a lot of my vacation days and use a lot of them out on the farm when we're the busiest. And my wife always jokes and says, make sure you save a few vacation days for real vacation.
So what are you talking about? Isn't driving them, isn't that a vacation? Well, and your window here that looks where the weather usually comes from, that's how you know, oh, great, I better take a vacation day because I don't see any rain system on the horizon.
Yeah, I'm always checking the weather, of course, and trying to plan my schedule at that time of the year. And yeah, where I sit here in my office, I can see the western sky coming a little bit. And our farm's about, you know, 20 or so miles northeast of here. And so usually my dad's calling me first and saying, what's it doing in Ankeny? Because it usually hits about a half hour before it hits over there. So, you know, I'm always the first line of defense, I guess.
You tell him it's raining now, so he's got 30 minutes before he better finish that field of spray, or he just better shut it off then because what's coming.
Yeah, here it's coming. And we'll look at the radar, of course. It's diving south. It'll miss you. Or it's moving north. It's going to hit you. It's moving north. It's going to hit you. So
the relationship there and the visitors that come to the farm, that probably sets you up for what your job is. I mean, we think about agriculture, about relationship. I'm not saying it's a sales job, but market expansion is about developing relationships. Where did you pick up that part of the skill set?
excuse me. I think a lot of it just has to do with you just learn as you go. And, you know, growing up on a farm, all this comes second nature to me. It's very personal to me as well. And went to college, you know, sports is always a big part of our life. So you're involved with sports and you get used to dealing with people and working as a team when you're doing that. And then, you know, I went to, you know, got my agriculture business degree at Northwest Missouri State and came back home and worked for Monsanto for a little bit, but then just decided I wanted to be a little bit closer to the farm. And, you know, how that goes when you work for a big company, you're going to be moved around a lot. And an opportunity came up here at Iowa Soybean Association. I've always been interested in the political side of agriculture and the international side of it as well. So this is just a perfect fit, and I've had a lot of great experiences here. Kirk Leeds, our CEO, has been a great mentor and a great person to learn from and to work for, and he's given me lots of opportunities. So I've gotten to see different parts of the industry here at ISA, and then you just learn to deal with It's about relationships and about people. That's what every business is really about, and agriculture is no different, and international agriculture is no different than that. You know, it's about customer relationships and building that level of trust, especially for buyers in the Asian market. They really value having those personal relationships.
Is the opening line always "tell me about your operation"?
You know, a lot of times we talk about the agriculture here in the state. All the foreign buyers that come through are always interested in, you know, what's going on in Iowa, because Iowa is well known around the world as being the center of the heartland of the United States and the breadbasket area. So a lot of them want to know what's going on here at the state level, and then it does end up coming back down to the local level. We take our board members, our farmer leaders with us, and they usually always give a presentation on their farm, the history of it. We talked about the generational aspect of it. We talked about, you know, so the long-term pieces of our farms and our families, but then we talk about the, you know, what's going on today and what's important to us today and how we grow our crops and how we, you know, transport them and store them. Really basic things in some regards we would take for granted, but, you know, we got to keep in mind a lot of other people live in a much different kind of culture and different environment than what we do. So they're not used to the same things that we do and the technology we use.
Well, trying to get time to talk to you is hard because you are gone a couple weeks ago trying to set this up.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, was it Pakistan is where you're at?
Yeah.
Bangladesh? What's the infrastructure like there?
Yeah, we went to Bangladesh and Pakistan last month, seems like it was a while ago now, but actually, no, it was a couple weeks ago. Earlier this month, it was part of last month and part of this month,
yeah.
I should say. So, we were over there, and it's a new market for us as far as from an Iowa perspective. We haven't visited that market before. Our international organization called the U.S. Soybean Export Council has consultants working on behalf of U.S. soybean farmers in those markets. And we've been working there for several years, but those markets were really buying virtually zero U.S. soybeans maybe 5 to 7 years ago, and now they're significant buyers. Bangladesh is over a million ton a year market of U.S. soybeans, and Pakistan's over 2 million tons, and both those markets are growing. And so we went there, and that was on a trade mission on behalf of our farmer members in conjunction with USEC, and we went to meet with those feed companies, those soy processors, those livestock producers, and also the government officials, everybody that's involved through the value chain in the trade process, and also the Foreign Agriculture Service folks that represent the U.S. industry over there in the embassies as well. So all those people are part of that value chain. In order to do business, you have to understand the culture and what's important to those people, and that's why we went there.
Is it harder to get that first million sold, or is it to go from 1 to 2 million metric tons?
It depends on the market. They're all different. Some markets are a lot more advanced. That's how we break down our marketing strategy too as an industry. We have our what we call mature markets. We have emerging markets. We have markets that are mature but still growing. You know, so some very early stage markets. So those are the kinds of ways we look at it, and it just depends on the market. You know, this part of the Asia subcontinent, which these two countries border both sides of India, basically, that's still a pretty young market and it's a growing market. So I think getting from zero to a million or 2 million tons, you know, took some effort, but I think we're there now. It will be more challenging to grow it beyond that. But the great thing is there is a preference for U.S. soybeans there. Those buyers are willing to pay a premium, we discovered as we were over there talking to them, because they recognize the value that U.S. soybeans provide when it comes to better digestible amino acid profile, better energy content. And we have a lot of research to back that up. And that's the other thing we talk to the buyers about is we are selling, you know, the research that we've done to demonstrate that we do have superior quality. We're not just saying it and asking them to take our word for it. You know, we're actually backing it up with real data.
You're able to slide something across the table and say, look at this, mm-hmm. what we've done.
So the next stage of it there is going to be just growing their poultry industry and growing their aquaculture industry. And we talked to the aquaculture sector, and they're very early stage in the development there. And so we have technology as a U.S. industry that we can help transfer over there. This is technology we want to get out there that can really help improve the aquaculture productivity of certain countries like this, which ultimately will mean that they'll need more feed formulation technology and they'll need more soybean meal.
And the quality side of things, we had this discussion just a few minutes ago in a video piece that'll be for Market to Market. You did talk about the premium, and what I was going to follow up with, but I knew that I'd rather have that discussion right here, is where's that line between a premium product and a premium price versus this is way too expensive? Because it's always the who's the cheapest at the Gulf is mm-hmm. the comment if you mm-hmm. read the market analysts mm-hmm. and what they – they're buying on price. They don't mm-hmm. care about the products or mm-hmm. the quality. Mm-hmm. How do you make somebody care about the quality?
Exactly what we're talking about here, where we talk about the you're going to get – you might pay a little bit more is how we have to demonstrate and show them, but you're going to get a quicker rate of gain on your animals. You're going to get a faster turnaround, and that is going to make the feed company and the livestock producer more money. So certain buyers that message resonates with, and they understand it. They're sophisticated enough. They get that. Other buyers – it is completely price, and the cheapest, and they don't really care about the other part of it because they're not maybe connected through the value chain as much. So it just depends on that. But there's certain markets definitely in the world, like the Philippines is a great example of this, and as we discovered, the Pakistan and Bangladesh is also another market. Other markets that are like this, they're willing to pay maybe $5 to $15 a metric ton premium for U.S. soybeans or soybean meal. So it just depends on the market, and you just have to wait and see. Yeah, price is ultimately still the big issue, but if we can be a little bit, demonstrate that we're just a little bit better, there's certain markets that are going to recognize that, and they're going to be willing to pay the premium because they know from start to finish they're going to still net out more dollars because their rate of gain is going to be better, their return on their investment will be better, because we do have the better, we've demonstrated we've got the better amino acid profile. And we have to talk about the difference between amino acid profile and crude protein. And crude protein is something that, Brazil tends to have a little higher quantity of. But crude protein, remember, is just a measure of nitrogen in the seed. So it's not telling you necessarily what the, you have a digestible amino acids and indigestible amino acids, things that are just get excreted out the back end of the animal. Mm-hmm. So, things that are kind of a waste. So, by just going off of crude protein, which some of the unsophisticated buyers of the world will tend to just look at that, that's not going to make them any more money. And so we demonstrate that with the buyers that will get that.
How long did it take you to understand to explain aminos and all of that? Was that all from the degree at Northwest Missouri,
or no? I'm
is
not
that on the job training.
That was on the job training there, definitely. I'm not a feed formulation expert by any means,
but it's extremely important for what you're mm-hmm. doing though. Now
it is. We have to understand it to the point, and we always will keep the technical experts where we'll introduce the subject mm-hmm. and then let the technical experts kind of come in and bring it home. And get into the science and the weeds. And we'll be working with the sales and the marketing folks a lot of times and the executives of the companies. And then we got to get the nutritionists and the scientists and the people that are more on the technical side. Then we put them in contact with one another, and they can hash out and look through the science of it and confirm it and so forth.
Well, it's like sales and marketing. Sales says one thing, but production has to – I don't know if we can do that. Yes, we can. No, we can't. People over-deliver on promises. All right, I want to talk about the map again. Mm-hmm. When you look at this map to your left, above your computer screen, how many of those countries have you been to?
I should have counted that one up. But I think
are we over 30?
I think I've been around 30, probably 30 countries or so. That's pretty close. China has been the one that we've been at the most over the last 10 years because it's by far and away the biggest market. A third of the U.S. soybeans before this current trade skirmish that we've had over the last 2 years used to go to China. So we've been there the most, but I've been to lots of areas now, Middle East, part of the EU, Latin America, Central America. Those are important, and all throughout Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia is a big growing area for us as well.
So even if you have 1 to 2 million in all those little countries, it's still not going to add up to what China's been able to do. Why is it that China – I'm guessing it took a long time to develop that market. and get to a point where they trusted you and would pick up the phone when you called or read the email when it was sent to even open up that channel of discussion. It couldn't have been an easy thing.
Well, that process really even started long before I was even working in this area. So,
well, let's go back to 1985.
1985 is when American Soybean Association opened up their first office in China. And at that time, China was a net exporter of soybeans. People don't realize, but China, soybeans kind of originated in Northeast China. So that's where they're from originally. And China is probably about the fourth or fifth largest producer of soybeans in the world, behind, of course, the U.S., Brazil, Argentina, India, and then there's probably China. So you're right in that category. So they're a big producer, and they were net exporter at the time. But the soybean growers at that time saw the vision, saw the population, and they knew that China was starting to develop a little bit. Remember, it was a very early stage in their development. They just started to open up. A lot of people, what we learned when we've been over there over the time is people point to the Deng Xiaoping era. You know, that was a little bit after Mao finally was out of the picture. And he was more of a open-minded kind of person who wanted to bring capitalistic tendencies back to their economy. So they started opening up. So our industry, I think, recognized that. Our growers did open the office. And so we worked with the feed industry because they were in the very elementary stage of understanding feed formulation. They were using slopping their hogs and what was left in the garbage, you know, and a lot of these small backyard producers of chickens and pigs and so forth. So when we introduce new production techniques and methods and show the value of sophisticated commercialized feed and vitamins and nutrients and all that goes with it, that then starts opening up more demand for things like corn and soybeans, and the production systems get more efficient, so they're not just a couple, you know, every farmer has two or three hogs. Now you have some hog confinement facilities and other things there. They've taken care of disease issues a little bit better, although they still tend to fight that problem just because of the way they're so close together. You know, the population's so big. But anyway, they continue to grow, and over time, you look at they entered the WTO in what, 2001 or 2001, and then they start buying some soybeans all of a sudden, and then they just keep growing from there. And we continue to develop their work with their sectors and kind of be that trade servicing help over there. And the aquaculture industry is the more recent example of success because they were very they had water pollution issues. They weren't, you know, again, it was garbage and manure-based feeds that they would be using for their fish feed. So you introduce things like soybean meal into the ration, all of a sudden the rate of gain starts getting a lot better, more efficient. You help them clean up their water and they grow their industry, and then they use more soybean meal. There's 500 million bushels of soybeans that goes into aquaculture feed worldwide now, and 20 years ago that was zero. So, you know, that's just, it's a slow process. Marketing, I've had people that have been in the business longer than I have that always says marketing is a process, and it takes time. It doesn't have immediate results usually. But you have to build those relationships, build that trust, and then you provide, you see what kind of service and holes or gaps there are, and then you go in and try to fill those and provide that opportunity in a way that's going to ultimately benefit our U.S. soybean farmers. We always have to ask ourselves the question when we do a promotion or research activity, will it sell more bushels of soybeans eventually?
Right.
Yeah, and will it sell U.S. soybeans too? That's the second piece of it.
While I was waiting for you to come down for our TV interview, I was looking at the shelves of things, and something caught my eye. And it was the pen that had the four soybeans in the top. And that's what I remember from the 80s and 90s of being delivered as a reminder of we're finding new ways and places and uses for this soybean. And it was since 85. Mm-hmm. That's when that had come along. Did you have to sell farmers? Now agriculture is a global game. There's no way around it. Whether you're in Iowa or Indiana or North Dakota, it is a global game. Is it, again, it's that 0 to 1, 1 to 2, which one's harder? Is it make it harder when people can email you and say, Grant, you went to China, but what's happened? Why are we in a spat with them? Why can't we get this convinced? Because they know more about what you're doing. Does that make your job harder or easier?
You know, some of these, we get all those kinds of questions, and it was a challenging process. We always warned everybody going into this process that this was going to be a challenging time for U.S. soybean farmers because we had already had pretty good access to the Chinese market. Now, we recognize there's bigger picture issues at play and other challenges in the Chinese market's not always, you know, been a transparent marketplace, that's for sure. And certainly the biotech approval process has been a challenge over the years, the irregularity of that. Sometimes shipments will get rejected for really not a very good reason. Or tariffs will go in place because maybe they had a big corn crop, so they just don't want to have as much corn come in. So those are the issues that do need to be addressed. But because the U.S. soybean industry already had a pretty good relationship, we knew we were going to be the tip of the retaliation, the tip of the spear. And we were right, as it turned out. We got clobbered, you know, in this process. We got hammered. So we at one point, 2 years ago, were selling 36 million metric tons of soybeans to China. When the tariffs started and the counter tariffs and retaliatory tariffs back and forth started happening, then mid-year, our exports went down to about 27 or so million metric tons. And then the next year or last year, they were down to 13 million metric tons. That's a major drop. We were able to rebalance some of those to other markets. That's what we have a program we call What It Takes. We had a What It Takes initiative to try to offset all the lost Chinese exports to other markets around the world. We were pretty good at getting a fair amount of those offset to other parts of the world, but still couldn't do enough of it. And so that's where we're at. And so we got, the retaliation, we were the brunt of that. Now, long term, if we can, you know, if the phase one deal is real, it's implemented, and if they can come up with, I think, a phase two deal, they're going to have to do that probably the next phase, and we can have stability interjected back into the marketplace, and maybe we can grow and gain some of that back. But it's going to take quite a bit of time. I think it's going to take more time than people realize. I mean, just like this phase one deal, people thought we were, you know, the traders and other people think we might start seeing purchases within, you know, a few weeks of the deal being implemented. And I don't think that's going to be the case, especially not for soybeans, because we have to compete globally. And because of the trade skirmish that happened, our global competition increased production the last 2 years. They really ramped up production, probably faster than they otherwise would have. So that's new production that's now permanently online that we have to compete against. And that's going to take time to claw that back, some of that demand back. And overall, we think the world demand will continue to grow, and it will, but it's going to take a while for it to catch back up to the amount of production that's now been brought online. And we're seeing the results of that with a record crop out of South America this year.
China's also trying to sort through, and they figure out that they have an appetite for renewable fuels. Ethanol is one of those they're kicking mm-hmm. the tires on of mm-hmm. their understanding the DDG side of it. On the biodiesel side, are you on a global scale yet in that industry, or are you still mostly a lot of domestic fights?
Biodiesel is mainly a domestic market for us right now because there's other major biodiesel producers and exporters in other parts of the world. Argentina has their differential export tax scheme that they have, and that basically subsidizes their exports of biodiesel to other parts of the world. And so some of that could be filled by them. Indonesia produces and Malaysia produces a lot of biodiesel because of the palm oil production in Southeast Asia. And Europe produces a lot of biodiesel through their rapeseed production. And all these markets are very protected markets. It's interesting how everybody puts on trade barriers and they do different things to try to protect their own domestic markets. So we have to do that too. Biodiesel in China probably has a ways to go because they have a oil deficit. You know, they need to import, you know, that's why they import whole soybeans because they need the meal and the oil. But they're importing as also palm oil. They're importing other kinds of oils. So until the day they become surplus of oil, I don't think you're going to see biodiesel move into that market very quickly because the food side of it, they need it for their population. Now, ethanol is a different story because they have excess production of corn there, and they have a growing livestock industry, so they do need DDGs, and they've got air quality issues. Biodiesel will be helpful for them, but I don't think they're there yet, but it sounds like they're getting closer to using more ethanol for their gasoline. I know they have a goal of, I think, 10% ethanol in their gasoline supply. It was supposed to be this year, but but I think they delayed that a little bit.
So it helps when you do have two hats when you walk into a room. I know that the one organization pays for that trip and that's mm-hmm. who they're for, but you can also be in the room and see an opportunity mm-hmm. to have a biodiesel discussion at another time. Is that
oh,
right?
Yeah. And I can't tell you how much we have discussions about corn and DDGs when we're on our trade missions too. It actually drives my CEO nuts, Kirk Leeds. He's like, we need to be going to talk to our friends at the Iowa Corn Growers or the National Corn Growers and ask them to pay for part of this
trade delegation
because
we're
selling corn and DDGs as well as soybeans and soybean meal. But it's all, you know, a lot of times the exporters are the same people. You know, our farmers in a lot of cases are the same people. So it goes together and they're all part of the same feed formulation in a lot of cases, and they complement one another. So, yeah, we do end up talking about other things really beyond soybeans, other parts of the trade, whether it's corn or ethanol or biodiesel or other things. And you have to be a student of government foreign government policy and understand what foreign governments are trying to do and how they manipulate the market a little bit to protect their own domestic industries. And that's what I always tell people about agriculture. Agriculture is probably the most there's probably the most government influence in agriculture that every country does this around the world, and I think any other industry, maybe energy would be the other one, because they're national security issues for every and domestic security issues for every single country around the world. So when people say, "Well, agriculture just needs to be a completely free market and work together and not have any kind of you can't have any government intervention," well, you know, in a perfect world that would be great.
It would be great, but I don't know how on earth it
doesn't work that way because of the way every other country around the world behaves and operates. And so if we could ever level that playing field, then that would be great. But we're not there yet, I don't think.
All right. When we wrap up here, I can't leave without discussing the challenges you've had to face in the biodiesel industry when it comes to the renewable fuel standard and the waivers that have been happening. Which one's been more frustrating for you? The trade side or trying to figure out, no, we need the waivers because it's just what's the headache medicine that you use?
A lot of Advil.
Yeah.
And then alternate with Tylenol.
There you go. Exactly.
I would have to say the last 3 years has been a more challenging time in my career working at Iowa Soybean Association than the first 15 years were. So it's been a challenging time, and it's been all those things together. It's almost unbelievable to think about how all these different headwinds have hit our industry all at the same time almost. And so on the biodiesel side, yes, it's been, since Administrator Pruitt was first appointed as EPA administrator. But even before that and under the Obama administration, we've had some challenges with the EPA, who has the jurisdiction to administer the renewable fuel standard. A lot of us have felt that they certainly have taken huge liberties and not followed the congressional intent of the law and how they've manipulated and come up with some of their programs when it comes to the small refinery exemption waiver program. And remember, they also tried to do reduce the actual volume targets a few years before that in what we called a NOTA thing that happened, I think, in 2018. So it was a supplemental rule that EPA proposed. Luckily, that didn't go forward, but they were going to reduce biodiesel's target in the RFS in that as well. But you know, there's that issue. There's the lapse of the tax credit that we've had the last 2 years. That was a major challenge. We had huge imports of subsidized foreign-produced biodiesel from Argentina and Indonesia that was coming in the country. We finally have some more certainty on all those issues. So far, we have some anti-dumping and countervailing duties in place to keep the subsidized biodiesel at bay and mainly make it so it's an equal price footing. They can import that stuff into the U.S., but it can't be subsidized at under the market value. Our producers in the U.S. just want to be able to compete as a fair market. So we have some certainty there. We finally got the tax credit passed, so we have some certainty there. We have a little bit of certainty on the small refinery exemption issue. You know, they came up with a process that they'll reallocate a portion of those, it looks like, based off of the Department of Energy estimates. It's not what we thought the president agreed to with our congressional delegation, but it's a step in the right direction. And then now you have this Tenth Circuit Court ruling that said that the EPA mishandled certain small refinery exemption waivers in the past, which then now might have EPA may need to go step back and reevaluate all the waivers that they've done, and maybe go back to where we always thought it should have been. Is that there's probably only about, you know, 5 to 9 legitimate waivers that should be granted, rather than the
50 to 90%.
Yeah, the 30 to 40 waivers that they have been granting. So maybe that's a step in the right direction. But I can tell you, the last 3 years have been crazy between the biofuels industry and then the trade sector.
Never a dull moment with Grant Kimberly.
No, especially in soybeans. It's been interesting. People say, I see you more on TV the last couple of years or on the radio because of all these issues. And I was like, I don't really want to be doing all this. I would be glad if things were calm, but that's not been the case here recently. But maybe we're turning a corner. Maybe things will start looking better down the road. We have a few things now working in the right direction. But again, like most things, I tell people, I think it's going to take more time than people realize, because you can't have some of these challenges that we've faced and just have it automatically be fixed overnight, whether it's the trade stuff or the biofuel stuff. There's damage that has been done on some of these things, and now we have to build these markets back up and hopefully make our industry and our farmers whole again. And it's going to take a little time.
And make more trips, whether it's foreign countries or states in the United States, to help on that mission.
Yeah, we're going to continue to fund our efforts to grow demand for soybean products, and customer preference for U.S. soybeans. We're going to continue to put our legislative efforts into growing the biodiesel industry in Washington, D.C., and making sure we protect the RFS, make sure the small refinery exemptions aren't abused like they have been, and make sure we have some stability in the tax policy. So all those things we're going to continue to work on, and make sure we get these trade deals signed and implemented, not just signed, but also implemented.
So what are you going to do on Tuesday? Because that sounds like a Monday.
Well, next week we're heading down to Commodity Classic.
Yeah.
That's where the policies are made for the industry. All the major grower groups are getting together for all the commodities in the United States. And that's where the leadership and the boards come together from all the states. And we set the policies and priorities for the coming year and years after that. So it's always a very interesting time to be there. And every year is different.
Well, and we appreciate you squeezing us in, and we'll let you get back to the planning of everything that you're going to have to do here in the next few days and weeks, years moving ahead. Grant Kimberly, thank you so much.
Sounds good. Thank you.
My thanks to Grant Kimberly from the Iowa Soybean Association and the Iowa Biodiesel Board. He has been a guest on this podcast, which is a production of Market to Market and Iowa PBS. I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening.